Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Women's Wednesday. Every Wednesday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another woman who has agreed to share her journey with us. And today's guest is no different. And my goodness, what a journey. I am very pleased to introduce to you Christian K. Collier, who is an educator and a writer from Eugene, Oregon, and the author of Housewife, Home Remaking in a Transgender Marriage. Christian Collier, welcome to Mind Talk.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Dr. Brewer.
Well, you know, it is really a pleasure. You have created a really interesting piece of work that I think will be helpful to many people. Again, the name of your memoir is Housewife, Homemaking in a Transgender Marriage. So let's start at the beginning of your book, which is when you sort of walk us through a water birth. You're about to have another baby. What's a water birth?
Right. A water birth is a birth that happens like in a hot tub or underwater, essentially. So the labor can happen in water or on land. And then the baby comes out in a place of water so that you don't have to fight gravity. In the pushing phase, it's an analgesic naturally. And the baby's already been in a place where they're not breathing air, so they just slide out. And then when they come to the surface, they take their first breath.
It sounds lovely.
It is, actually. It's a huge improvement over my land birth.
You know, I'm not used to hearing births described as water births or land births. So, you know, welcome to my new learning. You know, as you describe the birth and you describe your husband and just the whole scene, it just sounds completely idyllic.
It was incredibly blissful. And the subtitle of the book is Home Remaking in a Transgender Marriage, because I was already homemaking for sure. And, you know, the transgender piece shook it up to the point where I had to remake. But in the place where I was homemaking, I was really embracing that archetype of creating a home and a family. And we were so close. My husband and I had this completely peaceful, easy relationship. We'd only had one fight in over 10 years, and that was about where the Midwest was. And so everything was so sweet. And that second baby that we welcomed into the world was such an easy baby. And it was so wonderful to be growing our family and feeling so content and grounded with everything that I really kind of thought we had at that point.
And, you know, you talk about the one fight you had. It sounds like it must have been quite a stunner. Who won that argument? Where does the Midwest start? Does it include Eastern Wyoming or not? I just want to know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, according to my husband, it did not include Eastern Wyoming. And according to me, because I'd been looking at other maps and territories and I hadn't grown up in Eastern Wyoming, and I was, in fact, from the West Coast, so it seemed very Midwestern to me. But he had, there was identity issues there, too. So we ended up, like, really frustrated with each other in an alley in the middle of the night one night, and I was stomping on the ground, and all of a sudden we looked at each other and just started laughing. And we were like, oh, you know what? This is totally not worth it. This is such a funny thing to have a fight over after all these years. So we just decided to just throw in the towel together on that one.
Well, I guess you need to get at least one fight out in 10 years.
Right. Otherwise, it's not deemed healthy.
There you go. So, you know, you've had your baby. You already have a baby. Life is really wonderful and blissful. And then there's a fire.
Right. So our second child was 6 weeks old, and we woke up in the middle of the night to crackling and popping. And I opened my eyes, and the dog was standing over me panting because she was, like, terrified of anything that sounded like a gunshot. And I was just so concerned. And my husband at first wanted to just go back to sleep, and then he realized it was actually a house fire because he opened the drape, and you could see flames shooting out of the window right next to the bathroom. And so that was the beginning of a huge shift for us, because in that moment of the house fire, my husband started to kind of just reassess his life, because it was such a near-death experience that firefighters came through, and the fire chief said, another few seconds and you guys would have been under the roof. I mean, the roof was just about to collapse. It was an old house. It was amazing that we got out when we did.
You know, it's not unusual for someone to go through a traumatic experience like that and be catapulted into a different level of thought about the meaning of life for them today and for the days beyond. So that in and of itself, you know, kind of not that unusual. You then moved into a very interesting house that you didn't particularly care for.
Yeah, definitely. And we were grateful to have it because the universe had provided this loaner house at the same price as our other place had been. And we were, you know, just graduated college together at the same time and had, you know, our babies, and we were living on one income. So we were so grateful to have somebody offer us this great big house for the same price that we've been paying to rent a small house. But this huge house was a really creepy place. The upstairs had this room that locked on both sides of the door, and it had just a really eerie feeling. And even the downstairs felt not right. So we ended up kind of living on the middle level of this giant house that had this beautiful view of the city. And even people who came to visit us said, "Oof, there's something really not so great about this house." So it was a tricky place to be in transition, and we couldn't get out of there fast enough.
I can certainly understand that. And at one point, I think that you left and spent some time elsewhere.
I did. I went and visited my mom down in Northern California because, you know, here we just had this house fire, and I was not working outside the home at that time. I just had the kids, and I didn't really quite know what to do with myself when I had these big whole days ahead of me, and I didn't have all of my usual domestic activities to do. I didn't even have any furniture in my house. So I went down to stay with her, and during that week or week and a half, it was a time that I began getting to know my husband in a new way.
Well, tell us about that. There was a time when your husband told you that the two of you needed to talk. And
yeah,
typically when you hear "we need to talk," you know, folks come up with all kinds of anxious reactions to that. Tell us about your talk.
Well, I have to say it's an interesting thing. I have a lot of compassion for people in denial because in retrospect, I definitely experienced that. And at the time when he said, "We need to talk," I suddenly knew exactly what it was about. Even though it wasn't a concern of mine at all until then, suddenly these memories that were kind of disembodied memories came flying back to me. And the first one was a time when the waistline of my dress had been ripped out, and I discovered it in the closet. And I pulled it out and said, "What's going on here? My gosh, this is my favorite dress. What happened?" And my husband, who was sitting nearby, said, "I'm so sorry." And I looked at him with a beard and a mustache, the Alaskan fisherman, and he said, "It won't happen again." And I just said, "My gosh, you're kidding me." And he said, "Well, no, but I won't do it again." And I just didn't even know what to do with that thought of my husband wearing my dress. I was 18 years old as a new bride, and I didn't know where that information fit with my concept of my husband as a Wyoming rancher, as a former Marine. It just didn't make any sense. And so therefore, I just kind of discarded the thought of it. And then it happened a second time. And the second time, not only did I want to discard the thought quickly, but I also told him, "I don't want this ever to happen again."
That fixed that, right?
Tell him. Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm just telling you, don't ever do it again. And we'll just assume that's taken care of. And he said, okay, yeah, of course. And so I didn't ever see it again. But I did know that while I was away for any length of time, which has only happened a few times in the course of our marriage, my husband would become really depressed and would actually start drinking, which he never had a problem with when I was around. And he really, really hated himself. And I couldn't understand that aspect of him because I found him just wonderful. And we talked, you know, constantly and spent every waking moment together that we could. So for him to transform in these times that I was away into this dark and brooding person was kind of beyond me. So when I got this call at my mom's saying, "We need to talk," all of a sudden kind of had this, oh, feeling in the pit of my stomach. I think I know what this is about. And so I said, well, can you give me some idea? You know, I mean, I don't want to just be left hanging about what we need to talk about when I get home. And he said, well, it's about clothes. And I just had this sinking uh-huh. feeling, because uh-huh. what could it possibly mean that could be anything but very, very bad? And so he mentioned, you know, a couple, just a few sentences about, you know, how he really felt like he wanted to experiment with wearing women's clothes. And, you know, maybe it was because he'd grown up so conservative and expected just to wear overalls when he was a kid, and there were very clear gender roles. He wasn't sure exactly what it was about, but maybe it had to do with that. And so I got off the phone, and my mom saw that I had probably blanched, and she said, what's going on, honey? And I said, oh, you know, I just talking to my husband, and yeah, he's got this, you know, thing he's working with. And she said, well, what's it about? And I tried to explain a little bit about, well, you know, he's just, you know, opening up his concept of himself, and he's dealing with the fact that he'd been really forced to wear clothes and express himself in ways that he didn't feel were authentic when he was a kid. And he's just trying to figure stuff out. And my mom was not real impressed. She was not really thrilled with my husband anyway, to be honest. And I could never quite understand it, but she never thought that he was good enough for me. And this gave her one more thing to be kind of irritated about, even though I never told her that it was about women's clothes. She just chalked it up to one more reason why he probably really shouldn't be in my life. And that was just another sad thing for me. So I didn't share a lot more with her for a long time, for years, in fact.
For years. Okay. What was the trip like, leaving your mom's house, going back home, knowing that this talk was going to happen?
Well, I pretty much felt sick to my stomach the entire time. And when I got home, I have to say that it didn't feel like getting home in so many ways. First of all, it was to this house that I felt really uncomfortable living in. All of my things were at, you know, a factory, a warehouse being cleaned that had survived the fire. And so there was nothing around me that felt familiar other than my children, because even now my husband didn't feel familiar. And we went on walks together, and he talked about getting therapy and trying to understand this part of himself. And his therapist initially thought that he was maybe just an artist. And so it was all about, you know, being an artist and needing to explore his art. And he was relieved and even kind of ecstatic to tell me he was an artist. And to be honest, that also struck a painful chord in me, because I had always seen myself as an artist and being a writer and in trying to live my art wherever I can. And I hadn't written seriously for some time since we'd had children, because I was so taken up every day by the efforts of raising these babies. And I express my art in all kinds of other ways, everything from flower arranging to card making. And so I looked at him and said, you know, I'm an artist too, and that doesn't make me a man. And he went, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. Okay, yeah, sorry. And so he got a new therapist, which was nice. And it was a process over the next few years of really working through anything that could have been remotely like childhood trauma, and you know, his core values and beliefs, and so that he could come to some clarity about exactly what was going on.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You go through, as anyone, absolutely anyone would, lots of different feelings about what you were being confronted with, and this life that you had yesterday that now was going to be completely different, no matter what he did. And
yeah,
there was an interesting exchange between you and your husband when you basically told him that he didn't have what it takes to be a woman. You know, he didn't have the fortitude, the strength, the flexibility, the courage. He just couldn't do the woman thing. Talk about that exchange. What was going on for you?
Well, first and foremost, I really thought that I could probably convince him on a logical basis that this wasn't possible, because you know, as I said, we hadn't had any fights all those years. We had like one mind. We agreed about everything. Okay, hint, hint, right? Spoiler alert, Kristen, maybe the reason we have one mind is because we're the same gender. Didn't occur to me. But we had one mind in so many things, so I thought I could probably just point out the reasons why he couldn't be a woman. And yes, it was all those reasons that you said. And in addition, it was that culturally, even if he believed deep inside, he had not been raised as a woman and experienced resistance in all the ways that we do as women, from people telling us what we can and can't do, and then not deciding that we can or can't do those things accordingly, but rather knowing that if we do those things that we're supposedly not able to do, that we're going to be seen differently for that, you know, that I could arm wrestle, you know, a fair number of men to a standstill, actually. I mean, I have my own gender quirkiness myself, and I, you know, I was out there with the Pickmatics digging up tree roots in my Carhartt pants. I was, you know, I was a gender bending person in some ways in terms of gender roles, but I never had any confusion about my gender identity. And I never really thought about my gender identity, to be honest. I never really thought about what it meant to be a woman. I was just like, well, being a woman is just, it's like nothing, you know, it's like, guess what? It's like having an accent from the West Coast, you know, when you live in the West Coast, you don't notice it until you go somewhere else. And suddenly somewhere else came to me in the form of my husband telling me that he was a woman, and I didn't, you know, I was not perceiving him that way. So I said, you haven't experienced that resistance. You don't know what it's like to grow through that. You don't know what it's like to toughen your skin and, you know, push through no matter what and be who you're going to be, even though everybody else tells you that's not possible. And my husband listened to all of my thoughts on that. And then he said, you know, you're right. You're right. There's no logical way that I can be a woman. And still I can't explain it to you, but I am. And so now, you know, we know that there's evidence across 22 different scientific disciplines that there's a biological basis for being transgender. So there's a part of my husband's brain that was like a female brain, and they've documented that in postmortem studies, even without the use of hormones, that brains can be different according to their gender alignment. So in my husband's experience, he was not a man, and it must have been so confusing and difficult. And ironically, looking back now, I realize how much resistance it must have been for him to live through for me to tell him, and that was just the beginning, that he couldn't be a woman, you know? Like, talk about the things that you can't do and can't be, you know? Right. You can't be who you want to be. And there he was, rising to the occasion and saying, I hear you, and I can't help it, I just am. And that was just the beginning. The whole world told the woman who grew out of that she couldn't be a woman, and there she still stands, as my parenting partner say that.
The idea that you are actually standing in a room with your husband telling him that he doesn't have what it takes to be a woman, and then treating him exactly the way women are treated, very often women are treated, is, you know, in hindsight, it's actually a really kind of curious scene, if you will, out of what was about to turn into a very complex life.
Yeah.
Kristen, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will continue. Folks, I am speaking with Christian K. Collier, who is the author of Housewife: Home Remaking in a Transgender Marriage. We'll be right back. Kristen, talk about the early days after that first conversation. What were the many things that were going on in your mind? And what, if anything, did you say to anyone during that initial period?
Oh, my goodness. I was so scared. And it's interesting because I had grown up in a very liberal household, and I'd been a theater student, so I'd hung out with people who were presented in a lot of different ways in terms of gender expression, and had been a variety of sexual orientations. But this happening to my husband, this person that I was really depending on to form the structure of my family and my life, and really my identity too. I mean, it was part of our identity as a couple, but also my identity as a housewife, since I was throwing myself into it lock, stock, and barrel. It was so scary to imagine that that foundational piece was shaking in two ways. One way was that I questioned everything that had been before it. Like, I thought we were in love as a couple, and I thought that you were my man, and now you're telling me you're a woman. So does that mean that all of that wasn't true? And what does that mean for your sexual orientation, which are not, and sexual orientation and gender identity are not directly linked at all. They're separate, but they, you know, they have some places where they end up touching each other. So it was a little bit unclear what was happening at all for a while there. And for a while, she didn't know that she was actually needing to live the rest of her life as a woman, because you can be transgender and decide not to completely cross gender lines. You can just kind of hold that gender identity as part of your kind of male-female identity and keep the same body. So we were hoping that that's where it would end up. So we didn't know from moment to moment, day to day. So I didn't want to get too afraid of things that I wasn't sure what was going to happen. But on the other hand, I was planning for the future every moment, as we do when we're making a home, and trying to figure out how I could have a plan A and plan B, and then how I could talk to people about it. Because when I first opened up to a friend who was a very close friend, the person who I spent most of my time with, she listened to me, and then she said, "Kristen, that's not right. God wouldn't do that to you. That's not part of God's plan. You know, that's not healthy, and we're going to pray about it." And I felt, part of me wanted to say, yes, let's do that. You know, I want it to all change. But a bigger part of me thought, well, what if it's actually not unhealthy? What if it's actually what's true and what's right? Because goodness knows I haven't been able to convince her otherwise. And if I'm trying to change what is true and what's right, then am I really being a part of God's will in that? I mean, I was really confused and concerned. So I didn't speak to that friend about it anymore for a couple of years, actually. And slowly, over the course of the next few years, I came out to a couple more friends, one of them who lived overseas. And I was pretty sure she wasn't going to get the word out to anyone else that we knew. And she said that she'd seen a movie about it recently, and she had another friend who'd actually been through that as a partner. And she said, you know, if you're going down that path, there's not any room for you as a wife down that path, because first she's going to be a woman, and then she's going to have her life as this new person, and you guys don't have long for your marriage, and that's just kind of the way it is. I'm sorry. And that was pretty terrifying too. So those were the stories I got. And at the same time, I was researching on the internet to see what other people were going through this, and there was not a lot of information out there. So there was that period of about 3 years where my husband wasn't sure that he wanted to live as a woman. He was just exploring it, and I was kind of trying to make space for that. And at that time, we had a separate unit from our house that was like a little office where my husband would go every day to write in the morning from 5 o'clock in the morning until about 7 o'clock in the morning. And he would get up early and put on his women's clothes in his office, and he would work in his office that way. And I describe in the book this one point where I see my husband come in, and I'm actually doing laundry, and I've run across this bra in the laundry, and it's kind of, I'm kind of panicked at seeing this bra because it's not my bra, and I'm not sure what to do with it. And here in steps my husband in a skirt, and he doesn't see me. He just goes straight to the coffee and he's humming along, and I'm not seeing even a him at that point. I just see the back of this person's head and this short skirt and dang, these really nice legs and navy blue stockings. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, huh, I hadn't seen this view before. That's interesting. And so I'm kind of trying to get up the courage to see this possibility in this moment. And then my husband turns to me with his beard and, you know, strong jawline. And I just kind of, the whole thing falls apart and I just start to cry. And he is, of course, devastated that, that I've witnessed this, because he is very careful to typically change into his boy clothes to come in and get his coffee most days. And this had been just kind of a fluke. And I gave him a hug and we both just kind of held each other for a bit and cried. And then I said, you know, I think you should do your own laundry. And he went back to spa. Because it was just really hard for me to navigate that change. And I didn't want to say, no, you can't do it, because that was part of, you know, the exploration that he needed to go through. But I also didn't want to jump on the bandwagon and say, yeah, do that, because it seemed pretty clear where that would lead. So every day I would kind of peek through the blinds and see if I could see what my husband was wearing on the other side of the blinds in his office. And I could see, you know, kind of part of a woman's blouse, and then I'd kind of shut my eyes and, squeeze them shut, like, oh, I don't want to see it. And then I'd end up looking again. So I was really attracted to the truth, but I was also really scared of the truth. And every day was just like walking on eggshells in that way. Even though we had so much agreement and ease between us as people and as partners, there was this huge, really scary thing that had to do with identity that was standing between us.
What about the children? I know they were young, but did they have any awareness or did they notice anything?
During those 3 years where my husband was really exploring and trying to determine that, yes, indeed, this was gender dysphoria, which is that feeling of dysphoria from having a gender identity that doesn't match your body. During those few years, the kids didn't understand any of it because my husband and I were trying to process that together and on our own, and so that we didn't include them in the confusion and the mess of it. And we didn't want to include them in any kind of judgment around it either. And so I do think that they were affected by the strong feelings and the amount of tears that were shed kind of over and around them, because we were home full time and they were not in daycare and there was no really obvious place to get some space. I would, you know, maybe take them for a walk, and while they were in a stroller, you know, I would be crying, or, you know, while they were exploring something in the yard, I'd be crying. And I spent a lot of my days crying. And when my husband and I were together, we were often crying also. So I think that energetically did impact them, especially my oldest child, who had, you know, a really, really strong personality anyway. So yeah, it was kind of tricky living with and working with, you know, him in the mix. But by the time that things settled down in regards to my acceptance, so it's been about 10 years now since my husband actually had told me that he needed to live the rest of his life as a woman. So there's kind of the 13 years ago, women's clothes, 10 years ago, he told me he wanted to be a woman for sure. And when we told the kids, at that point, they were between 3 and 5, right around there. And so they didn't have a really strong concept of what gender was anyway for themselves. And it wasn't a big deal at all. And one of the reasons that we felt it was a good idea for my husband to transition while they were young was because it would shake them up less, and therefore our family up less, and their future lives as adults would not be, you know, would not include the trauma of having to explore their own gender identity in the shadow of somebody changing genders who was so close to them. So, So basically, the main concern from my oldest son was that he was afraid that he wouldn't recognize his dad in the morning because she would be a woman. And so Seda, my parenting partner, who, you know, from that point we were trying to use female pronouns, explained that it wouldn't happen overnight. It would take several years, really, but it would be initially, you know, a year before she was living full time as a woman and would even really look a lot different. And so my son was really relieved to hear that. Of course, my husband wasn't thrilled to have to say that answer because she would have loved to have had the change be overnight. But that it doesn't work that way. It takes years for the hormones to really take effect and reshape the face and the body. And of course, he was working on electrolysis at that point to remove his beard. And the youngest had no concerns at all. And so it was very easy to proceed with them. They actually changed pronouns immediately and would remind me when I goofed up and called her a him.
Interesting. So, you know, yesterday he was Fred. Mm-hmm. And then in a moment or two, he was Seda.
Yeah.
She was Seda. Yeah,
she was Seda, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As this was going on and your husband was going through therapy, were you in therapy?
I wasn't. We were really living on a shoestring. We didn't have insurance at that time, and we were living on one income. So him going to therapy was obviously absolutely necessary. At the time that he actually came out to me as a woman, which was a huge jarring thing, even though there had been 3 years of exploration, it was very, very fortunate that I had been for the week prior at a family camp. So again, you have that theme of I'm gone for a week and then it comes to some deeper clarity. So I had the children with me and we were at a nonviolent communication or compassionate communication family camp, which was the kickoff to a 9-month-long program called the Parent Peer Leadership Program through Bay NVC or Bay Nonviolent Communication. And in that week time, I had been in intensive workshops examining my own heart and my own hang-ups and healing whatever I could, and so that then I could be of service as a teacher and a lay leader with compassionate communication to other people, particularly parents. So the program was designed to put us into a position of leadership at the end of the 9 months, but the primary purpose, the first few months especially, really focused on us moving through our stuff, learning how to use it so we could be a model and so we could be really familiar with the processes. So I was assigned an empathy buddy for that program, and we spoke with each other for an hour every week, and we exchanged, each of us got a half an hour to be listened to without judgment, and just have the reflection of feelings and needs and, you know, the basic humanity reflected back to us rather than being advised on what we should do or one-ups that, oh, you think that's happening, let me tell you this. You know, all of those other strategies that we often use to connect with each other were out the window. It was just solid empathy, which I think really is one of the best forms of therapy. And so I was very fortunate to have that built in, and built in at a price that I could afford. And that continued. And I continued also to explore in journals where I would write down my, you know, concern, like, oh, you know, and I might write it in this form and say, my husband says he wants to be a woman and I'm furious. I don't get it. You know, I think that he's not thinking of us. Okay. Well, thinking that he's not thinking of us is really a judgment. So I could unpack that. And I would then go, okay, what's my feeling there? I'm afraid because I'm a little confused about whether he's given this thought. And I'd love to be clear about that. So that's something I can ask him. That's a conversation I can have. Okay, so suddenly I was shifting from being in a position of having things happen to me and being at the whim of fate to being empowered in this new language that I was learning. I was translating my own judgments into a place where I could see that I had the power to request of my husband, you know, help me understand how much thought you've put into this. Help me understand what your journey's like so that I don't think that you've just come up with this right now and it's going to have a huge impact on our family. And so he could come to the conversation, which was a conversation that was much easier to have and more healthy than if I just said, hey, you ruined our lives. You ruined our family. I mean, I know that my husband would have just run and hid from that conversation, as would most people. So it was amazing to be doing that work and stepping into my power right at a time when I could have very easily been apt to crumble.
Well, and in fact, in that kind of situation, I would suggest that many people, if not most people, would be angry and want to know how their partner could conceivably do something like this and, quote unquote, ruin the family. So, you know, being able to come at yourself and your husband from such a different perspective, and you're talking about NVC, nonviolent communication. Say more about that.
Sure. Nonviolent communication was pioneered by Marshall Rosenberg in the 1960s, and he basically had a PhD in psychology and realized he was still cussing at drivers in front of him in traffic, you know, for going too slow. And he thought, well, gosh, you know, I paid a lot for this degree, and I'm still cussing at these people. I'm still, you know, feeling so angry and so powerless in my world, you know, surely there's got to be a different way of doing things. And so he started to examine our language and realized that we have so many words of judgment, whether they're words like rude or mean, or they're words like good and nice. Because, you know, even if I tell somebody, oh, you're really such a nice person, then that person, first off, would be a little confused about what it is that I liked about them so much. And second off, would be probably a little bit worried that they might fall off the pedestal. So that can actually be a little bit unnerving to be in that position of being admired in a blanket way, rather than me saying, you know, I really appreciate that you came and helped me weed my garden at a time when I was feeling so overwhelmed. And it's such a relief to know that I have the support of my community. You know, so to be able to explain what it was that they did that was such a help for me and why is a totally different thing than just saying you're nice. And the same thing for when we have judgment about somebody, you know, when I see a child take away something from another child, if I just say, oh, that's bad, we don't do that, that's wrong, then that child has, in addition to the frustration that cause them to first grab the thing from the other child, they have now the shame of that everybody thinks that they're wrong in having done that. And now they're probably going to lash out, which is going to give them one more layer of pain as they see that they've impacted people negatively and they get punished. So instead of that, if I see that in terms of, wow, you know, hold on a second, I see that you guys both want the same toy at the same time. And I'm sure that if we check in, we can find a way that you guys can both get your needs met. You know, would you be willing to hand me the toy for right now? And we'll hold that aside until we figure out a solution that works for everyone. It's a really different place to come from when you take away that judgment and the shame and the blame. This is a key piece too, because that's one of the things that I really wanted to share in the writing of this memoir, because everybody has a transition that they go through in their relationship, whether it's the birth of a child with a disability or an affair or an identity shift, and which happened in our case that had to do with gender. But how we come to that transition, the way that we remake ourselves, you know, that home remaking, identity remaking, the way that we have this choice to dig deeper into who we are and what we stand for, that's an opportunity. Those crises provide us an opportunity. And if we come to the table with compassion, there's such a huge potential for growth. And that growth will serve us not only in that relationship, but in all relationships. And that growth and that connection, that quality of connection that we foster during that very difficult period of time, helped us to really remake our family and our home in a way that is quite unconventional now, that I wouldn't have dreamt of going out and trying to build, but is actually very, very functional, in which Seda and I are now parenting partners to our two kids under one roof, but Seda has her own wing of the house. And I have a romantic partner that lives with me in my side of the house. and he cooks meals for us 5 or 6 nights a week, and we sit down and share our family dinners together, just as we always have. My kids are now 14 and 16, almost 17, and it's such a joy to have this harmonious, peaceful place where we work out conflict still on this model of compassionate communication, that we rise to see each other every day with the expectation that every behavior is an attempt to meet a need. So we try to understand, where did that come from? If we didn't connect with the behavior itself, well, where did that come from? Because we can surely connect with that universal need that it came from.
Kristen, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to continue this exploration and talk more about crisis as a way of providing opportunity, which is not at all how many, many people react or even think about crisis. We'll be right back, folks. Kristen, the idea that crisis is also a opportunity is an interesting one. And certainly for many people, the idea that a crisis is anything other than a crisis is kind of a stretch. But in fact, it seems to me, if you consider that a crisis, while it's not something that you look for, not something that you want, not something that you enjoy, but if you can see it as an opportunity, it gives you back your power, as you were talking about earlier, and takes away some of that sense of hopelessness that often, and helplessness that often arises in the moment of crisis.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I think that in a crisis, one of the things that happens in most crises is that our identity is shaken, our ego is shaken. And we wear a lot of different hats and a lot of different roles. In the crisis that I went through with my husband announcing that he was a woman, my identity as a woman was shaken. My identity as a housewife was shaken. Even my identity as a mother was shaken because, you know, single mother versus mother in this, you know, domestic, cozy, 4-person household with a white picket fence, it was going to look very, very different. And when those pieces are shaken, it's very, very uncomfortable. And there's a lot of tears and a lot of resistance. And I love the idea of embracing anger. It's not like you have to stuff it. We can look at anger and go, okay, there's almost always a thought behind anger. It's an interesting emotion that comes up, and it's out of our resistance to a particular thought. So I had lots of thoughts like, you can't be a woman, and, you know, you're ruining my family. And rather than forcing those thoughts away from me, I tried to welcome them and translate them and try to understand what were the feelings and what were the needs underneath those thoughts. You know, why was that so terrifying? And I found that my core values around that were that I so wanted to contribute to a healthy, wholesome life for my children, to give them the family life that I hadn't had as a kid. So that was an extra layer of fear that was added just because of my own, you know, upraising. I was like, I don't want to give that. I want them to have something really loving, something really solid. And so when I connected with that, one of the things that happened was that I turned to the garden And I dug deep into the garden and started planting and providing food with perennials and with annuals. So we now have raspberries and boysenberries, and we have asparagus that produce year after year. And then on top of that, we have all of the annuals that we grow because I wanted to bring the health of the planet into our world. So I redefined and started creating new identities for myself based on what I discovered with my heart broken open were the things that were really most important to me at the core. And that's a way of witnessing ourselves that we don't get to do without shaking off and breaking those layers of identity. So we can really examine ourselves and go forward living in a new way and, interestingly, have less fear. And that's a fascinating piece of having come through that crisis, is that those years that I didn't tell anyone, the amount of tension and anxiety that I lived with, the amount of tears that were around fears of things that hadn't even happened, was extraordinary. And once I started telling people, and in general, it was very well received. There was only a couple of people who chose not to stay close with us. It was amazing to me to see that I had inside of me what it took to meet every day with a level of presence that made it so that I could deal with whatever difficult thing came my way. So trust became not about trusting that somebody would do something for me, because that's outside of myself. Trust became a focus on myself. Can I trust myself to come with my inner resources of patience and of presence and of the ability to see the best in everyone, including myself? Can I come with those resources to every situation so that I can be my creative best in opening the box to all of the possibilities that could meet my needs and the needs of those around me, to really cultivate my awareness of everyone around me in that place? So it changed the focus of my life, and now I live with so much less fear for everything, which is fabulous, because in getting this book out there, of course, that's a risk for my family and for me, but it was an easy thing to do because of the process that I've been through in studying compassionate communication while I was living this extraordinary challenge.
What has been the response to your book? What have friends, families said to you? How have they reacted to you?
It's been overwhelmingly positive, which is fabulous. I'm glad that people find it to be an easy and fun read, and uplifting has been the theme of what I hear back. What has really surprised me is the number of trans people who have read it and written back just the most heartfelt letters to me about how it shifted their perspective of their partners going through the transition process with them, to help them really see from an outside lens what that would be like. Because when people transition across gender lines, they necessarily do what we all do in our teen years of trying to understand ourselves and define who we are. And it's a very self-absorbed process. And it's tricky doing this as a 40 or 50-year-old person, or 30 even. And so it really, the book has given them a different light, a different lens to what their partner's going through, and more compassion. And then they're offering it to their partners, of course, to read too. But I anticipated getting a lot more resistance from trans people because, of course, you know, it was not seen from their perspective. Even though I definitely honor and have so much deep respect for that, I really spoke to my own story. And there's very few stories out there from a partner's perspective, particularly a partner with children who stayed in some way in the relationship. Even though we didn't stay in a romance relationship, we stayed within a household and we stayed supporting each other's truths. So there's that level of unconditional love and family that has continued. So, I've been really pleased with the responses so far.
Well, you're certainly right that I don't know that there are any, but if there are, it's a very small number of pieces of writing from the perspective of the partner. So, it again, it's very important and eye-opening, I would say, to clinicians as well as to laypersons, because it's just... it's so open and it's so honest, and it really takes us through the stages that you and your parenting partner went through. Tell us about Ben. Who's Ben?
Ben was the second person. So I stepped out of my romantic part of my relationship when I realized such strong attraction I had for a man named Jack. But that relationship didn't fully fruit into a physical relationship, even though it was deeply romantic in a lot of ways. So I let that one go. I had a little bit more clarity about what would work for me and what wouldn't after having been through the rigors of a marriage that in some ways wasn't working for me. So I was learning. And then I met Ben, who was my music teacher. And Ben came from a household where it was a very different culture than the one I'd grown up, but it was very typical of what has been. He was 17 years older than me, and he was Jewish and male, so he hadn't had to do any housework when he was a kid. And he had values of being a musician and of living life lightly. And I wanted to not be in judgment of where he was in the world that way, but I also had to kind of take a step back and acknowledged that I really loved homemaking. I loved putting a lot of energy into it. And even though he was happy to partake in being part of that home and part of our family, he wasn't really interested in being a part of the team to create it. So I had to determine how much energy was I going to put into that, which helped me to really examine the stereotypes around men and women and what the expectations were for them. And help me decide what was important to me and who I wanted to gift with those energies towards homemaking. So my relationship with Ben lasted, I think, a little less than 3 years. But it was really an important relationship in helping us to determine as a family, including Seda, that it would make the most sense for Seda to have her own wing, which Ben did some help in creating for Seda. He did the plumbing on the unit, and we had a lot of friends who pitched in and helped with different things, again, trying to make it on one income. And so our house structure grew out of my relationship with Ben, and he lived with us part-time. And then at one point I moved to Key West to live with him for a few months, but it was always held the idea that if things worked out in Key West and we were going to live there, that Seda would come and join us. So we definitely had the sense that we were a family of five. But it was an interesting dance to figure out exactly how to partner with two different partners, one romantically and one more domestically and platonically, and that was my parenting partner, Seda.
It's interesting. I wonder what that was like for Seda when her wife, former wife, was in the company of another man. I wonder what that was like for you when your former husband, now your parenting partner, was in the company of another woman or another man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an interesting process, I think, because everything happened in kind of slow motion, which was really a joy to capture, as you said in the book, to capture all of the stages of grief and then of celebration as this new person was born in the person of Seda, who is really much more like my husband's sister than my husband. I feel like my husband died. I'm more of a widow than a divorcee in that regard. And so because her sexual orientation kind of clarified as being more heterosexual, which it clarified at the point where she did have a relationship with another woman who was gay. And so it was kind of an interesting clarification for her and for me to see that indeed I wasn't jealous when she was with somebody, you know, in a lesbian relationship. Feelings didn't come up about that. I was totally supportive of that. And I was surprised by that. I was glad for the test because we both knew that she was supportive of me being in a relationship with another person. She wanted me to be happy. She really grieved the process of transitioning because she didn't want me to be without what was so important in my life in terms of partnership and romantic partnership. And, she, you know, we kind of both felt like all bets were off about our marriage. You know, what we had committed to wasn't in existence any longer to to rise to day after day. We loved each other tremendously, but we were really, especially she was, a different person. So it was interesting to notice as I went into relationships with other men, there was those two other men that were kind of like the exploratory, and I didn't want to do that. Gosh, it was the last thing I wanted to do. I thought I was married for life. I wouldn't have to be single again. It was not fun having to go out and look. And I'll tell you, the third time it was even harder because those two relationships kind of just naturally occurred within my interests. And when I went out to find the person who I am now with, it's been almost 3 years. I literally, we met online because I don't go to bars. I don't go, you know, out, but I had to put up an ad that said, looking for someone outside of the box. and he was definitely outside of the box. So that was great. And it's interesting when people have, when I have had dates, a lot of times they are concerned about what it's going to be like to meet Seda and whether there's going to be that tension. But because she's a woman and because she's not attracted to me anymore and I'm not attracted to her, it's very different than living with my ex-husband. It's a completely different scenario. And if it wasn't, we would still be married because that was the main thing that was missing, was that chemistry.
Interesting.
Above all else, you know, it really wasn't the body parts shifting that was the major problem. It was the chemistry. And I didn't realize that until I met the person in the book I called Jack, who helped me to realize, oh my gosh, I'm definitely heterosexual. And this is the chemistry that I most want to be with in a romantic way.
Kristen, I wish we had hours and hours to talk, but unfortunately our time, you know, I feel like I'm like we're just kind of touching on the surface of the beginning. So I am going to ask you for a website or something so that folks can learn more about your journey and your book and just all the things you're doing.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot more information on my website at kristinkcollier.com. So that is KristinK Collier, Collier.com.
Terrific.
That's the best place.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank
and really,
you.
Thank you for this book. I think it will help many, many people from many different perspectives.
Oh, I so appreciate you taking the time to talk with me. It was just a treat.
I'm delighted. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is available on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26 by 2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, send an email to Pamela, Pamela, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk today. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it is unacceptable. You take care.